So I come at this actually originally from a pediatric oncology perspective. So I'm going to start by giving examples of a couple of patients that I saw in the Jimmy Fund Clinic at the Dana-Farber. They were sort of typical. So the first patient was a 9-year-old girl who presented to a pediatrician with, turn these off, with a fever and bruises. She got a blood test and then a bone marrow test that revealed that her bone marrow had been replaced by acute leukemia cells, acute lymphoblastic leukemia cells, or ALL, and so she was enrolled on what was a standard chemotherapy protocol, which was like 9 different drugs in rotation and combination. She entered remission in 3 weeks and is still alive and well. And then a few months later, there was a second patient. This kid happened to be a boy, about the same age, same presentation, same diagnosis, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, was enrolled on the same treatment protocol, so got the same drugs, same hospital setting, so it was as close to a controlled experiment as one could do in a human being, because of course response to any kind of therapeutic intervention is not only a measure of the treatment itself but how it's delivered, so that was controlled, but this patient didn't respond unfortunately, and died about 6 months later. So the overarching question that I'm sure you've been addressing in this course also is generally how to understand this clinical variability and to discern whether there's a molecular underpinning to that variability. So we're particularly interested in this patient who responded particularly well, and so did what is pretty straightforward, which is to do a standard chromosome analysis, karyotyping experiment using some molecular techniques known as fluorescence in situ hybridization. Details don't really matter, except to say that while it wasn't apparent at the routine morphological analysis of the chromosomes, if you look molecularly, it was clear that there is a translocation between chromosomes 12 and 21. That fused two genes, actually two transcription factors, one called TEL, one called AML, to make this TEL-AML1 translocation. And it turned out that while it hadn't been previously discovered, actually the majority of known genetic abnormalities in childhood leukemia, the lion's share of those actually have this translocation. And of those patients in retrospective and now prospective analyses, about 90% of those patients survive. Turned out the patient number 2 had a different translocation, a 922 translocation that fuses two genes, BCR and ABL, that you've probably talked about, and it's known that these patients, given the same therapeutic regimen, only have about 10% survival. And so these are molecular tests done at the time of diagnosis. So what I think this really sets up is, which is now perhaps generally accepted, but was really emerging at this time, was the notion that cancer is a genetic disease, it's one second, and that the outcome, clinical outcome, is predictable based on molecular determinants at the time of diagnosis, as long as you know what to look for. Yeah. This is before Gleevec. Turns out that even with Gleevec, which targets BCR-ABL, in these patients, it's not particularly effective.
What is the one?
Uncharacterized multiple balanced translocations that identify a single oncogene at a breakpoint. So we started thinking about alternative ways to try to think about molecular classification of cancers more generally, and this is just the obvious kind of experiment. Two biological states that could be clinical states or biological states that you collect some kind of genomic information on, like microarray data, and then have this pesky problem of actually trying to figure out how to interpret the patterns that emerge. And I'll say quite a bit about that part because it's tough. If you talked about the non-analytical but sort of the sort of laboratory aspects of microarrays at all? Let me just spend one slide talking about this. So all of the microarrays are based on the basic principle of somehow labeling mRNA or its derivatives from a cell and hybridizing to probes on some sort of a solid support, whether it's a microscope slide, a silica wafer, something. They're cDNA arrays and they're oligonucleotide arrays, and you can either make them yourself or you can buy them commercially. cDNAs generally take the form of two-color hybridizations, where you simultaneously hybridize a test sample and a reference or a control, whereas the oligonucleotide arrays generally use a single color. This is completely and entirely a historical artifact of how these things were developed. There's nothing intrinsic about cDNA arrays that makes them require two-color hybridization. The only reason for using two-color hybridization is if the quality of the arrays is so bad that you need an internal control for every spot. Otherwise, you can't interpret the data. And such was the case for the earliest cDNA arrays, which are the first ones to be made. And I would venture to say that cDNA arrays, in general, are going to become obsolete very quickly in favor of oligonucleotide arrays, probably commercial ones. The genome is finite. Once you have the genome represented and identified, probably not much advantage to making your own. And most of the arguments that say, oh, we can make them much cheaper, making them ourselves, are usually sort of Enron-type accounting practices where you don't sort of, well, we didn't count the cost of all the people involved in making these things. Oh, we didn't include the fact that we spent 3 years trying to figure out how to do these and they didn't exactly work. When you really get right down to it, usually buying them is cheaper and they require quality. Should also mention that there are non-microarray-based expression profiling methods, like serial analysis of gene expression, or something called MPSS, that are transcript counting-based methods, where you use essentially DNA sequencing to enumerate the precise number of copies of a given transcript in a given cell. And the proponents of this method say, and they're correct, this is the only way to really know how many copies of a particular transcript there are in a particular cell. I would say that's absolutely true, but it's actually not that interesting, because for most biological questions, it actually doesn't matter how many absolute copies of a transcript there are. It's not that useful information. What's useful is to have some kind of comparative experiment that tells you there are more, with statistical significance, more in this sample than that sample. And rarely do you want to know that there are 682 copies, you know, but it is true. But I would say that the low throughput and cost of these counting-based methods greatly outweighs the benefit that you get from this absolute counting-based method. Yes?
If you have more copies of like this is what we're talking about with the same gene, they're looking for copies of the gene?
Well, copies of the transcript, not of the gene. So you could say, we identified a million total transcripts in a cell, of which 684 were transcripts from encoded by gene X. Right? So That can be useful kind of quantitative information, but not so useful to, I mean, these experiments are still, you know, many thousands of dollars per sample.
When it comes down, though, to like a pharmaceutical company trying to figure out the mechanism of the disease and actually how to go in and develop target drug molecules that might interfere, like, I'm assuming that this technique would be useful. For example, if you do one of the above two, oligo or cDNA array, and you don't know the quantitative number of transcripts you have present, you just know sort of qualitatively more or less compared to disease state or non, or and two people saying to each other.
Yeah.
If you know a number, and doesn't that give you the ability to make speculation about, you know, how those transcripts are being processed and whether that's an important process in the pathology of the disease?
I would say it doesn't, actually, because if you tell me, you know, if God tells me that there are 684 copies of a given transcript, I don't know what that means. I do know what it means that if there are, you know, five times as much of a given transcript in a disease state compared to a normal state, I can at least say that having one-fifth the number of transcripts isn't sufficient to give you the disease state. Right? Whereas if you just give me an absolute number without a comparative sort of thing, I don't know what that means, and I'm not sure that saying there's 600 in this state and 3,000 in that state, to me, that's not really more useful information than knowing relative abundance.
So it's really like a question of how what the resolution is in terms of how many transcripts. And that's like, you get an exact number for the bottom, but for the top, you get a sufficiently resolved difference between samples that you can say,
that's
one
right.
to five.
Instead that's
of,
right.
You know, 104 to 500.
That's right. And I would say for most biological and clinical applications, knowing that the ratio is 1 to 5 gives you about 95% of the information that's useful compared to saying it's 500 versus 100. You might be able to think of some special experiments where you really want to know the number, but usually it doesn't help you very much, in my opinion. There are all sorts of sources of variability that we won't discuss, except there's only one that matters, and that's the biological and clinical variability that goes into these experiments. There are a lot of people that spend a lot of time hand-wringing over these various technical things, and none of them make any difference, really, as far as I can tell, because they're overwhelmed by biological variability. So making microarrays that are somewhat more accurate or precise in their measurement won't actually make that much of a dent in the problem, because that variability is exceeded so tremendously by biological variability. That's all I'll say about that. So let me give some examples of applying this, and I know you've discussed these general methods before, but that's okay. So here's an experiment where we are interested in the differential clinical outcome of children with a brain tumor called medulloblastoma. Have you discussed this particular example? Okay. So we had 60 pre-treatment biopsies of patients with this brain tumor. Tumors were biopsied. And we knew the long-term clinical outcome of these patients, whether they survived from their disease or they died despite therapy. So they had the tumors removed and were treated with chemotherapy and radiation. And we knew that some of the patients survived and some of them did not. And based on that, we said, well, perhaps there are two classes, subclasses of the disease. So we clustered the data. This was across, I think, 6,800 genes on a microarray. So each dot represents a different patient sample. We said, well, if there are two classes, let's cluster into two groups because we have a clinical suspicion there are two classes. And of course, if you ask the algorithm to cluster into two groups, in this case it's something called a self-organizing map, but it doesn't matter. You could take the two major branches on a dendrogram from a hierarchical clustering dendrogram, whatever, you get the same picture. You get two classes, and the patients are shown there, about equally distributed. And now if we fill in the labels of the patients, that is whether they're survivors, turned out to be survivors or not survivors, you get this picture, where you don't need a statistician to tell you that there's no correlation between this class structure and survival. So what do you take? What do you think of this experiment?
What do you guys think of this?
What can you conclude?
What are you going to do with this? How are you going to rescue this? Are you saying that there's no signature that fits survival? What do you say?
There's a difference that it may not be related to the human.
Maybe there's a subset of human survival.
Right. So I think you're both hitting on the relevant point here, which is that the unsupervised learning clustering algorithm found some structure, dominant structure, that made these two classes. They just don't happen to have anything to do with the question that we're interested in, which was one of survival. And so that gets back to this basic notion of two general approaches to data analysis, which you've probably discussed, but I think often gets confused. So unsupervised learning, which is not exactly synonymous with clustering, but it's a reasonable first approximation, or supervised learning classification. So here, you're interested in finding dominant structure defined only by the intrinsic gene expression patterns in a given data set, irrespective of anything you happen to know about the samples, such as their clinical outcome. Here, you're saying, whatever, maybe there's some other interesting biological structure, but I'm not interested in that right now. I want to know whether there's a gene expression pattern that's correlated with the thing I care about, in this particular example, outcome. So we take the same data set, the same matrix of data, samples by gene expression values, and now apply supervised learning approaches. This happens to be a k-nearest neighbor classifier. Again, it doesn't make any difference what you use here. And this happens to be an 8-gene model. You classify the samples using a leave one out cross-validation approach so that you attempt not to overfit the data, the model, to the initial training set. And then you ask, well, of the two classes that are predicted, how do those patients actually fare? And here is a survival plot in terms of months of survival for those patients who are predicted to be alive versus those that are predicted to be dead. So what do you think about this?
So you did this? You want to pick those genes?
Is this significant? How would you... So if you look in a basic biostatistics textbook about how to calculate statistical significance of a Kaplan-Meier survival curve such as this is, they'll tell you to do the log rank test. And if you did that, you would get a p-value that, if you've looked at a lot of these things, would sort of match your intuition for this degree of separation. Okay. So it'll look something like that. Is that reasonable? Right. Well, I mean, that looks quite significant. But you should ask, well, how come this model has 8 genes, for example? How did you choose that number? Well, it's quite easy. We chose that because it worked the best. Worked better than 6, worked better than 10 or 50. So we should have to pay some penalty, right, for overfitting a model potentially to this particular data set. So the ways that you could then really test the statistical significance of this model would be to apply it to another data set. That's the gold standard. But short of that, a reasonable thing to do to better approximate the significance is to try to take into account the fact that there are a number of parameters of this model that were optimized to fit this data set. And you can do this by doing a permutation test where you don't scramble the gene expression values themselves, but you randomize the class labels in terms of are the patients alive or dead. And you go through the same procedure of attempting to build an optimal classifier and choosing the optimal number of genes to ask, if you really try hard with these machine learning methods, how often can you make a classifier that works as well as this one does? And when we did that 1,000 times, 9 times out of 1,000, we could do this well or better. So we estimated the significance of this model here, which is still, you know, decent, but you can see we took a couple of a hit of a couple orders of magnitude on this p-value. So if you had had a nominal p-value of 0.05 or something, right, that result would entirely vanish when you appropriately attempt to correct for such multiple hypothesis testing. And this is independent of what particular classifier you use. So I would say much of the literature, and you know, everyone's figuring out how to do this sort of as we go along, but much of the literature and worries about failure to reproduce an initial model are due to the problem of overestimating the significance of an initial model because of these overfitting types of problems. So let me just make a couple of general comments about supervised learning. And some of them may seem obvious, but turn out to be actually problematic. And this is one example. So the first step, establish the class labels of what you're trying to classify. So in one of our first experiments where we were trying to classify the two different basic types of acute leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia or acute myeloid leukemia, the way you would build a classifier is to choose examples of one class, examples of another class, and then find gene expression patterns that are correlated with that. Well, who's to say that we have these right? Right? What should you use as the gold standard for these things? It's not always obvious, particularly for the very things that we want to build better molecular classifiers for, because the current clinical diagnostics are so poor, it doesn't really feel like a good gold standard to go back, rely on the clinical labels as the gold standard. And so this is, in general, a real problem. For survival studies, if you force the question into a simple two-class problem, survivor or non-survivor, well, everyone's a non-survivor at some point, so at what point do you declare that a patient is a survivor of their tumor, for example? That requires some judgment call in terms of which bin to put the samples into. And I would say that much of at least our effort and time has gone into trying to figure out how to get this right. And there are some approaches that one could take to not have to be so rigid on how you assign these labels, but it's a challenge. So the second general step in making a classifier is selecting the features that you're going to feed into a model, features in this case being genes. The details don't matter. There are a whole long list of ways that you can rank genes. This is a simple one that is based on the mean expression level in the two classes and their standard deviation. It's a relatively unsophisticated way to select genes because it assumes that there's a uniform behavior of these marker genes in the two classes, which in many cases is not at all the case. There are many other methods as well. And then I'm sure you've talked about these at length, so I think maybe I'll skip this, that you then take these things and classify. So for unsupervised learning, there are all these methods, and I think they basically don't matter. That either for clustering or supervised machine learning methods, if you get a result that is obtainable with only one magical, you know, one person's really special algorithm, I would worry deeply that there's a problem with, you know, there's an information leak somehow or something's not right. Because at least in my experience, when there's really biologically or clinically meaningful structure to be found, you can find it with a number of different approaches. And in fact, that's a reasonable sanity check to make sure that you can recover structure, whether you're using machine learning or unsupervised clustering algorithms, that you can recover it with multiple different methods. There are some examples to that can be interesting, but on the whole, I'm confident saying it doesn't really matter, and it's really the input to these data sets that matters the most. That is, are you really sampling the diversity of, for example, the disease process that you're studying with the samples that are in your initial data set? What's more challenging is how do you evaluate the output of these clusters in terms of their biology, in terms of really knowing how robust the structure is, given any algorithm, and then how do you actually know when you, having seen a given structure once, how do you actually apply it to another data set to know whether it's, you see it there as well? It's not obvious. So let me give a couple more. Any questions about that general stuff? I wasn't going to say any more because I know you've covered it. Let me give a couple other examples of applying these principles to some data sets. Did you talk about this one?
No.
Okay. So here, again, focusing on childhood leukemia, most kids with childhood ALL respond to chemotherapy. I told you about this subgroup of BCR-ABL patients that does not. Another group that does not respond well are infants less than a year of age who generally don't respond. And it turns out that most of those patients have translocations into a gene called MLL. But it's clinically of interest because these patients don't respond to conventional chemotherapy, and this just shows you that using standard clinical criteria, they're hard to distinguish. So what if we take conventional ALL samples, these infant MLL rearranged leukemias, and some AML, the myeloid leukemias, and we apply an unsupervised learning approach. This happens to be principal component analysis, but could be your favorite clustering algorithm. What do you see here? Three different classes. Why do you say that?
Jose, speak up.
You're maximizing the separation, so you see some separation from the MLL.
Okay, so right here. So, yes, you see three classes, but only if you have the colors filled in, right? So if you imagine this is just a group of leukemias, you might get the sense that there, you know, was something going on over here. But you know, if you imagine these all black, it's not so obvious. Maybe.
All the genes analyzed or have been optimized?
No, this is completely unsupervised. So that's the first point, is that these things often look clearer when you actually impose knowledge on them, even though the structure here is done in an unsupervised way. You get this sort of impression that it's a really clean result if you superimpose knowledge afterwards. Okay, so that's the first thing. But let's say, yes, there are three classes, and I think you can appreciate that. One question was, well, maybe these infants with the MLL rearranged genomes in green, maybe they don't respond to therapy because they're babies and, you know, that this is a metabolic post-metabolism problem and their leukemias are the same as the conventional ALLs shown in dark blue. This would argue that it's actually not the case, that they're fundamentally different leukemias. Is this helpful? So it's sort of helpful maybe from a taxonomy perspective, but does it tell you what to do for these patients? Right. So what if you wanted to gain some biological insight into what was different about these MLL green infant leukemias? What might you do? You've got these data. You see that those patients define a different class. What could you do?
Anybody have any idea? What would you do with this? So it's the genes whose weights explain the most this separation.
That's right. So you could do that. As it turns out, in this case, there are a lot of genes that actually have relatively equal weight, so you still have a large list. And the three principal components don't perfectly separate the classes. So you could go back and say, well, now I believe that these MLL leukemias are a distinct entity. So now you could go back. That would be reasonable. Don't get me wrong, that's a reasonable thing to do. But the other way that you could do it is to say, well, now this tells me that I believe that these MLL leukemias are a distinct entity. Now let's use supervised learning types of methods to identify the genes that are most correlated with the class of interest, for example, high in the MLL class versus the others. That would be a straightforward thing to do, right? So you could rank the genes according to that distinction. So we did that and did what I think,
so,
yeah.
So in the first case, you would be comparing the between the different classifications, the different genes, gene expression level, or whatever. And the second case, you're just looking at the one classification. Is that correct?
No. Well.
No, I think it's more that if you didn't have these colors to look at, and you said, ah, there's some structure here, I don't know what it is, what's the biological basis of this structure, looking at the weights of the genes that are driving this distinction would be a reasonable thing to do. In this case, we had a specific question, are these leukemias unique, or are they admixed with the others? Having determined that they are unique, it's a little bit cleaner to say, all right, let's use supervised methods to find the genes that distinguish one class from the other. Of course, if you had perfect separation, it would reduce to the same experiment. But because it's imperfect, there's some advantages to using the class labels here. I should mention also that you see this blue guy here sitting in a sea of green. So this is a patient that, based on gene expression, one would predict to be MLL rearranged, but the clinical record for this patient said he was not. But when we went back and actually looked at this, it turns out that there was a missed translocation into the MLL gene that you could recover by FISH. So, you know, this is not a public health menace, you know, diagnosing these leukemias properly, but there are examples of missed diagnoses that I think can be, I think looking at these multi-parameter gene expression readouts can serve as a unifier, an integrator of lots of upstream genetic activity. And so I think the power to detect those upstream events is going to be higher when you look at some downstream pattern, such as an RNA pattern, as opposed to developing specific tests for each of the individual genetic abnormalities that could cause the same phenotype. Because in the end, all you care about is knowing whether the molecular program has been activated. But so if you rank the genes according to this distinction and just start at the top of the list, here is the gene that was top of the list of 12,600 whatever that were on the list. And any time a tyrosine kinase rears its head in a cancer classification, cancer biology experiment, you pay attention to it, particularly given the Gleevec story, right? So what do you think about this? I tell you, oh, look at this. Expression, the RNA level of a kinase, a receptor tyrosine kinase called FLT3, is characteristically high in the MLLs compared to the others. What do you think of that in terms of potential therapeutic significance?
So, yeah, what would you do with that?
Check the, or maybe this already popped up, but can't you check the levels in the other two classifications to see?
Because these kinds of levels are lower.
Right, so we define this list by virtue of the fact that it's high in the MLLs compared to the other two combined.
How do we get therapeutic KI?
To a FLT3 inhibitor?
Yeah.
So you want to treat patients with a FLT3 inhibitor. well, that's not an FDA-approved drug, so you can't do that.
Yes, what else do you have?
So there is. So there are. So the underlying question is, the hypothesis would be that MLL leukemia cells are dependent on FLT3 kinase activity for survival. If that's not the case, then you don't care. Then unless that's the case, the overexpression of this thing is totally irrelevant from a therapeutic perspective, right? So you could do that genetically, for example, using RNA interference to knock down the expression, or you could do it pharmacologically if there was a compound in development, not yet a drug, but a compound in development that inhibits kinase activity. So that's what this experiment is.
So this is something in mice, right? But in people, doing RNA interference, is that something that you can just do?
You can do it in, you can't do it in vivo in a person, but you can do it in human derived cell lines.
So clinically, then that would not be a
It depends on the hypothesis that you want to go down that path.
I see.
That's right. Now you can make the argument that, well, you know, doing these things in cell lines and mice, that's not real disease, and so I don't care what any of this stuff shows. But still, if your hypothesis is that a given gene, the overexpression of a given gene is important, and you do the experiments to ablate the expression of that gene and nothing happens, that should deflate your enthusiasm a little bit. Okay. So here's the experiment, though. Here, now taking patient-derived human cells that have been engineered to express firefly luciferase gene so that they glow, and you can monitor in vivo tumor burden. So here, mice that on week one you inject in the tail vein infant leukemia-derived tumor cells, and you see over 4 weeks' time the amount of luciferase activity increases as the cells grow, and the mice start to die around week four. And here is a cohort of mice also injected, but treated with a drug once a day by mouth that functions as a FLT3 kinase inhibitor. And you can see that the development of the leukemia is significantly abrogated, which, at least to our first approximation, validates the hypothesis that FLT3 overexpression is not just a diagnostic marker of this class, but it's actually a potential therapeutic target. And so based on this and some other preclinical data, the clinical trial that you wanted to do with a FLT3 inhibitor is being planned to treat patients.
Yeah.
So the cells are infected with a retrovirus that contains the cDNA for the firefly luciferase gene, so that if you inject these mice with the compound luciferin, they will emit the same enzyme that fireflies do, and they will glow. So usually this is done in vitro in test tubes, but here you introduce it into the cells in the animal so that you can monitor. What you used to have to do would be to inject a whole bunch of mice, kill some of them here, kill some of them here, and then like examine the bone marrows to evaluate the progression of the disease. What's nice here is that you can follow a cohort of mice non-invasively.
Let me ask a dumb question. I've never done this. When you actually look at these mice, can you tell that they're fluorescing?
No.
No.
No, you need to use a special device that can measure, I think, in the near-infrared range. There are green fluorescent protein mice that actually do glow. You can tell that they're green.
The mice that you use, are they immune, like rad knockouts or something, so you don't have a massive immune response?
Yeah. So you have to do this in immunodeficient mice so that they don't reject the human tumors.
And how do you account, like, does that factor at all in your determination of, like, the degree of, you know, the potency of the spread of the tumor cells and whatnot, because of just sort of the fact that the immune system can direct attacks against. And so when you're considering these experiments and saying, okay, I see this, you know, spread across the entire mouse in this level, and, you know, how do you factor that in?
You don't. You factor that in by saying that there are many things that are occurring in these models that don't recapitulate what happens in the mouse. Most people don't get cancer by having intravenous injection of a tumor into them. You know, most patients have an immune system. You know, so I think it's just one of the limitations that, yeah, it would not be worth the time and expense to have a drug development project around every, you know, little inkling that comes out of a microarray experiment. So you need to do something, even though it's deficient in many ways, and you've hit on some of them, to say, is this interesting or is it not? I think not yet at the point where one can do this entirely computationally and have any kind of, you know, confidence. That being said, these so-called xenograft models where you put human tumor into a mouse model are not particularly predictive of efficacy of a drug in a human clinical trial. But in the absence of anything better, it's still what most people do first.
Is the converse so more robust? In other words, if there's no effect from the xenografts, then you're really a loser if you go to the human?
No, it's actually more, if anything, it's the opposite. That if you show some activity in the xenografts, you often see activity. But failure to see activity,
right,
failure to see activity in xenografts,
oh,
is not particularly,
oh, okay,
particularly for molecularly targeted therapies, where you, it may be that you can show in the mouse that you've really shut down the pathway. Let's say you've inhibited FLT3 completely. So some people are drug companies are starting to use xenografts in that way to say, all the mouse is a test tube so that I can ask, have I inhibited FLT3 enzymatic activity, yes or no? If I have, and I believe that FLT3 is a good target, I don't care whether the tumor's actually shrunk or not. I'm going to bring it forward to a clinical trial. But you need something to convince you that the target is reasonable. Yeah.
I'm interested in the picture. So the small spots in the CP3 mouses are tumors, and then the purple ones are the xenografts, right?
The tumors.
Yeah.
But that means the spots are all very fixed in specific areas of the mouse.
Yeah, I think you see them there because the cells, they're injected intravenously in the tail vein, but they home to the bone marrow, and you're seeing large bone marrow cavities, which is why you see them kind of over the flank there. I think I'm going to skip this. Okay. Did you talk about this?
Nope.
Good. So when you do these experiments, the data usually present you with one of two problems. After you do all this appropriate correction for multiple hypothesis testing that I told you about, you either, despite having done that, still have a list of genes that's too impossibly long to bring biological understanding to, or you've corrected away everything and you have the impression that there's actually nothing that is differentially expressed in your two cases. And so let me show some of our more recent approaches to dealing with this, because it's really substantially changing our thinking about how to do these kinds of experiments. So this is not a cancer example, but a diabetes experiment where there were patients who were either adult patients who either had type 2 diabetes or they were normal as defined by having a normal glucose tolerance test. and they underwent voluntary skeletal muscle biopsies under euglycemic clamp. 18 of these patients, 17 of these patients. It's a simple two-class problem, right? Get the expression data to identify those genes that are differentially expressed in these two classes. Do the appropriate permutation testing to make sure that you correct for multiple hypothesis testing, and here's the result. Nothing neat significant. So out of the 20,000 genes on the array, even the top-ranked gene doesn't meet statistical significance. Possible that this is the case, but the question is, are there other ways that you might go about recovering a biological story here? And so the way that Vamsi Mutha and graduate student Arvind Subramanian took to this was to define groups of genes or gene sets whose activity as a collection of genes could be interrogated in these data sets. And we could have a rich discussion about how does one define such gene sets. You could do it based on the literature. So ask Zach what genes are important in, you know, some pathway that he knows something about. That could be a list. Or you could say, we don't trust Zach about, you know, that sort of, that'll bring Zach's bias. We're not interested in that or anyone else's intuition. Let's just experimentally derive lists of genes by one way or the other. Perturb cells, get the gene expression change, and that makes a gene set. Okay? And you can collect as many of these as you could stand. For these experiments, we made 150 of these gene sets. Okay?
Before you go on to speak about biases, how come Mutha is twice on the slide?
Oh, yeah. Bias, yeah. Enrichment. Yeah. Yeah. He's enriched, yeah. He should be. So then how do you do this? So first thing you do is rank all the genes on the array, 1 through 20,000, according to how well they're correlated with the distinction. And I already told you this top one, even that one, doesn't meet significance as a single gene. And then you interrogate each of these gene sets and ask, are they enriched? And so here would be an example of a hypothetical gene set, show each gene in the gene set of a dozen genes or whatever, that is not enriched towards the top of this rank-ordered set list. Whereas here is a hypothetical gene set. It's not perfect, right? But it's non-randomly distributed on this rank-ordered list. It's enriched towards the top.
Todd, do you see this as a similar operation to the following? There's a bunch of programs out there that look at, for a given microarray result, at gene ontology, and say what classes of gene ontology are overrepresented in a given in the set of genes.
Yes, that is. So you can define these gene sets based on a gene ontology annotation. That's an example. The important part is to make sure that you appropriately correct for testing all these gene sets. So now instead of 22,000 genes, we have 150 gene sets. But that you should think of like 150 hypotheses, right? So you should do the same sort of permutation type of testing and say, if I randomize, in this case, the diabetes versus normal distinction, is my favorite gene ontology class still enriched? And that's what some of the current approaches to that kind of annotation don't do. And so you can codify this in something called a Kolmogorov-Smirnov statistic. It doesn't matter. You can come up with an enrichment score for these things. And if you do that in this example, you essentially get one gene set which meets... No, just which gets quite high statistical significance for a set of genes. So how do you reconcile this? How do you reconcile this thing and this thing? How could that be?
That's my point. I want to understand what you just described. So the first thing, you're saying that you didn't pick up any difference in the expression
on a gene-by-gene basis.
On a gene-by-gene basis.
Right.
But then when you group a couple of them together, all of a sudden there is a difference.
Right. So how could that be?
How could that be?
Because they were always bigger than the sum of the parts. Getting more than information out of that. Maybe a weak signal, but it's amplified across many physical hearings.
Jeff?
Yeah, actually, maybe a couple of genes being combined in a certain fashion, maybe one up, one down, and then better.
Yeah. Right, so the microarrays themselves, the precision of these arrays, you know, is not so fantastic, and so you can imagine that there's a subtle signal on a gene by gene basis, it's difficult to detect it. But if you consider the coordinate regulation of a group of genes all in the same direction as a group, this might be quite striking, and this is shown right here, which is really quite amazing when you think about it. So here, we'll look at the mean expression level of all the diabetic patients versus all the normal patients. All the genes on the array are shown in gray, and so as you would expect, there are no outliers, right? There's nothing really way off a diagonal. If there were, those would show up as single genes that were differentially expressed. Of course, you could have one massive outlier that could screw you up with looking at the means, but still, you get my point. And here are these oxidative phosphorylation, the gene set that was defined by those genes that are involved in oxidative phosphorylation. And you can see that with only a few exceptions, they're all lined up just below the diagonal. Their change in gene expression is only about 20% compared to normal, but it's all in the same direction. So 20% change in this number of genes is quite significant. So this...
Are you getting that? Let me try to, because it's an incredibly important point. The chance, if you look at any given dot, of being, what it means for it to be one on just near the diagonal, but on one side or the other, you might make a much story of about. But I think it would be a coin flip, the fact that it's on one side or the other. And then just by dumb luck, they're all on one side of the diagonal, even if they're close to the diagonal, that's got to be incredibly unlikely. And so each individual gene being on one side of the diagonal, the fact that all genes that you've pre-assigned beforehand with being other types, in this case oxidative phosphorylation, they all end up on one side of the diagonal, that's hugely unlikely, the fact that you can just, by dumb luck, put them all on one side of the diagonal.
So it's less tied to the enrichment levels, more to the probability that you find, as you're saying, that the... Given that you've said these are genes that are should be related in some particular fashion.
Yes.
I think that makes
sense. That's right.
And they behave together across this.
That's right. Because if you look, if you, you know, take this point in isolation, you know, there's no way that's going to be significant it's because it's right in the middle of, you know, in this thing. So this is sort of an eye-opening experiment, and it's causing us to go back and reanalyze using this methodology, it's called gene set enrichment analysis, some old data sets. Let me give you a couple of other examples of unpublished examples that in slightly different use it in a slightly different way. So I told you about our medulloblastoma outcome prediction experiments before, and around the same time there was a paper published that looked at the same question essentially. Non-metastatic versus metastatic medulloblastoma. Different patients, different arrays, different group, whatever. They made a classifier that was centered around the PDGF receptor alpha gene was a predictor, and also a number of the downstream players of PDGF receptor alpha. And so we asked, are any of, when we look at our classifier of outcome, which I showed you is pretty decent, where's the PDGF receptor alpha pathway on there? And neither PDGF receptor alpha or the genes in that pathway were among the top predictors, like top 50 genes in our data set, which I think would lead one to believe that one or both of those data sets is wrong, or the models derived from them are wrong. But if you take this PDGF receptor alpha related genes as a gene set and ask, is it enriched in our data set using this methodology shown schematically here, it's enriched. See, they're not at the very top. This list is you know, 12,000 genes long or so. So you can see it's they're not all stacked up like 1 through 50, but they're non-randomly distributed, which we take to mean that actually the two data sets are consistent. If you had data sets of infinite size, then you'd start to see convergence of the markers being overlapping at the very top of the list. But with these smaller data sets and the clinical variability,
puts some formalism around what Botstein was waving his hands and yelling about for the prior 5 years. People said, well, this microwave looked at it. You can't tell the difference.
Yeah.
It's the pattern. It's the overall pattern. This is a much more formal way of capturing the pattern as it relates to a particular set of biologies.
So here's another example of that sort of thing, also unpublished. So we looked at lung cancer, human adenocarcinoma of the lung, and identified some, we just drew the line at 50 because it's a nice number, predictors of outcome in the Boston lung cancer patients. University of Michigan did the same experiment, published around the same time, overlap in gene of these two lists of 50 genes, zero. Concerning. But if you look in the space of gene set space and you ask what gene sets are enriched in one data set, what gene sets, which you can think of loosely as pathways, they're not really pathways, but it's reasonable to think of them that for this purpose, there's really quite significant overlap in gene set space. So I think what this is saying is that Botstein is right that there is more biologic coherence in these data sets. It's just we haven't been smart enough to really know how to see it.
How did you choose your gene set? What do you use to pathway? How do you actually?
So this comes from, we now have about 450 or so such gene sets, some of which are good, some of which aren't particularly useful. They include some Go annotation. I don't think those are particularly useful because the granularity isn't fine enough. I think in the end, the most useful types of gene sets are going to be those that are experimentally derived. But this is a mixture of those, and we're not yet at the point where we even started to try to understand, like, of these 35 enriched sets of genes, what are they and what's the biological story?
So if I read it right, you threw at it on the order of 60 gene sets.
No.
No?
No. We threw at it 400 and something gene sets and asked how many of those are enriched in the Boston data set, and the answer was 35 plus 18 and 35 plus 12 were enriched here, and so the majority of the sets that are enriched in one were also enriched in the other.
That's helpful.
Are those cancer-specific or just biological?
No, they're not cancer-specific.
And those gene sets are
They're a combination, as I said, of some are like these Metacarta pathways that are sort of so-so annotation. Some are entirely computationally derived, that is, they're the nearest neighbor genes of a given index gene in a data set. They are various things. And, what the definitive collection of gene sets would actually look like isn't obvious to me.
Collectively learn more and more about mechanism.
That's right. And so I think the way to do this, on the one hand, I think it will be useful to just not fret about it too much and worry about exactly how to define these things, just get them in there. The nice thing about this GSEA methodology that I didn't really go through in detail is that it's forgiving. How you calculate these enrichment scores is forgiving of the definition of the gene sets because you're looking for a non-random enrichment of the gene set. So the fact that, a third or a half of the gene set may actually be inappropriately there doesn't make any difference because there's still enough that's significantly enriched to detect it. You can. We didn't happen to do it here, but you can. Again, like any of these other things, there are going to be a number of different metrics that you could apply to measure significant enrichment. The most important thing is just to make sure that you correct for the possibility of whatever metric you use that you're detecting something beyond what you'd expect by chance. Okay.
So I have two questions about moving forward enrichment. One would be, so I'm assuming that you can also detect, like, you have a depletion of a particular gene, and which you haven't mentioned so far as an example of, you know, actually this is lower expression or whatever. Is that something you would find by going back to, like, your healthy samples and comparing, you know, looking for enrichment relative to your disease?
Yeah, a paucity score?
So actually, the way you calculate this is the metric doesn't specifically look for enrichment towards the top. It looks for a non-random distribution.
Right.
So you would find depletion. What you can also find, which I think is this score will capture and is not desirable, would be like something that's concentrated in the middle, which is very uninteresting. And so there are some false positives in it.
For example, in T cell activation, you get, which is, like normal T cell activation, you get upregulation of certain proteins and you get downregulation of others. And so, what I haven't heard yet is how you account for perhaps, enrichment of part of your gene set, depletion of another without.
So there is another version of this that tries to dissect the gene sets into those components that move coherently in one direction versus the other, because you're absolutely right. If, for example, you use Go annotation or something like that, or some pathway, if half the genes in the pathway go up and half the genes go down, that could look like no enrichment at all. Whereas if you separate those somehow, you could see it. How are we doing for time?
You've got 20 minutes, 18 minutes.
Okay. So let me push this to not just classification, but some newer directions that we're thinking about. How can you use these signatures for useful things, particularly to think about something that's sort of closer to drug discovery? So this is the way the usual kind of discovery pipeline would look like. You have some disease process or biological process you care about. You do some microarray experiment, and then a miracle is supposed to occur whereby you develop sufficient molecular understanding of what the data are telling you that you can identify the smoking gun target, and then you partner with a drug company and say, screen for a small molecule that inhibits this critical therapeutic target. The problem is that this part is really tough. And so what we've been thinking about is, well, could you bypass the understanding part, at least initially, whereby you screen for small molecules based on their ability simply to perturb a signature of interest. And then once you have those in hand, you could use them to further dissect the biology, or if you're lucky, think about them like drugs. And so the proof of concept experiment is shown here, where here are two biological states, for example, a leukemia cell, which is undifferentiated, and a normal blood cell, which is fully mature and has differentiated along the myeloid pathway, a peripheral blood neutrophil. It's not known what the critical targets are of this pathway, so it's hard to do a small molecule screen to induce this process, which would be nice if you could simply induce your leukemia cells to turn into normal cells. So the question is, could we define a signature of this state, a signature of this state, and then screen for compounds that trigger the signature? So the details don't matter here, but the concept is, define signatures of the two states of interest. So we call this thing GEHTS, for gene expression based high throughput screening. Define the signatures. Standards, what we've been talking about on microarrays, where the experiment would be treat cells with various different chemical compounds and ask whether any of those compounds trigger the signature of interest. And to make this feasible, we simplify these complex signatures into a handful of genes that you could measure by multiplexed PCR.
So was that, I mean, I read the paper, was this purely a cost issue as opposed to going direct for microarrays?
It's a cost and throughput issue. Yeah, so if you wanted to...
Pretty good. Very concluding.
If you wanted to screen tens of thousands of compounds,
right. Yeah.
Not really feasible if it costs you, you know, $500 a pop in the throughput issue there. So, yeah, it's a practical matter here. This part doesn't matter. Suffice to say, there's a method for how to measure a simplified signature in high throughput. So we screened a couple thousand compounds and asked, do any of them trigger this little mini five-gene signature? And some of them did. Details don't matter. So then the question should be, well, maybe these things just trigger these five genes that are, I mean, sorry, the, these compounds trigger the five genes but actually don't do anything. So one way that you could sort out whether they actually do anything biologically is to now step back and look across the whole genome again, take cells, treat them with these candidate compounds, and ask, did you actually recapitulate the overall molecular program, not just of these five genes, but of the whole thing, of the whole molecular program? So if you turn back to genome-wide arrays, you can see that a number of these compounds recapitulated the molecular program of differentiation. Does that make sense? So you use the simplified high-throughput assay just as a readout of whether you've triggered the signature or not. And then with those candidates in hand, you go back and interrogate them.
Does everybody follow that?
So the genes in this little signature itself...
We don't know if they're actually doing anything to the rest of the cell.
Oh, almost... I'm pretty confident they don't, actually. But it's irrelevant. So you define these signatures not based on their being important, or somebody thinks, oh, that's a good target, and you know that's important for leukemia or differentiation or whatever. It simply...
It represents a class.
It represents a class, all you care about, and that you can measure it well. So sometimes you find a good candidate marker that for some reason it doesn't behave nicely in this assay, so you chuck it out and replace it with something else. So here's just an example to say that then, as you might expect, when you treat leukemia cells with these candidate compounds discovered solely based on their gene expression changes, they do the thing, the cells do the things that maturing leukemia cells should do, like they become phagocytic, they start engulfing.
They're becoming much more differentiated, like the behavior.
Yeah. So, it's sort of a promising idea. This is one unpublished example that says, well, you know, it is known that blood cell differentiation is largely governed at the transcriptional level, so maybe that's why you can define these transcriptional signatures of the differentiation process and screen for things. But here's an example of defining a gene expression signature. Again, the signature itself is devoid of any real biological meaning other than it reads out, in this case, activation of a signal transduction pathway. So, I mean, the usual way of thinking about this is, well, if you want to look at signal transduction, you know, proteins talk to each other, RNA has no place in that. RNA profiling has no place in that. But here the idea is, if we stimulate a signaling pathway, in this case, by stimulating cells with platelet-derived growth factor, and then capture the transcriptional response at the RNA level, could we use an RNA signature as a readout for PDGF receptor activation and screen for inhibitors of the signal transduction pathway using RNA as a readout? And here is the work of a MIT graduate student, chemistry graduate student, who pulled out a compound called orine tricarboxylic acid as an example, which turns out to be a previously unknown inhibitor of the PDGF receptor itself. But it was discovered by looking down here at a signature. So I think this is going to be useful for various, being able to screen for things that you can't otherwise screen for. So this is a chemical structure that is not currently being explored in people who know much more than I do about kinase inhibitors. because no one thought to look at it, and it was discovered simply by using it as a signature as a readout. So in the last 5 minutes, let me push the signature idea sort of perhaps further than I should, but it's the end of the class, and I'm kind of excited about the idea, but it has less data surrounding it. And that's the idea of using these signatures. So you can see, at least in my thinking has shifted over the past year or so, much away from finding, oh, what's the needle, and using these microarray types of experiments to find needle in the haystack, what's the gene that's responsible for something I care about, to thinking about the power of these signatures as readouts for various things. So the idea here is to use the signatures, RNA signatures, as a vehicle for establishing connectivity between components of the genome and each other that you manipulate through perturbation. It's a little bit different than relevance networks, I think, but it's conceptually similar in some ways. Establishing connections between drugs and drugs and drugs and genes. So the idea would be that if you can define a gene expression signature of, let's say, comprehensively, of all drugs. There are only about 2,000 FDA-approved drugs. It's actually amazing that that's just not publicly available information. What happens to cells when you treat them with drugs we give to patients? If you had that, and for example, you had a signature that was a result of ablating each gene in the genome sequentially, there are only 26,000 genes in the genome, and there are now reagents coming online with RNA interference where you can actually do that experiment, then you'd have a systematic matrix of perturbations whereby you use these gene expression signatures as the sort of universal bioassay to connect genes with genes, genes with drugs, and drugs with drugs. Does that make sense? Do you have a question?
There are some problems of RNA using that doing experiments in the human cells, and there is such a paper out in January, in February, isn't it using like using RNA and putting that like TFF alpha or signal networks, but they are putting that in the elegance. But I'm just questioning, how do we connect from the elegance to our cancer cells, especially the mammalian cancer cells? But because of him, because of that network is pretty conserved, so they say that it's a lot of
relevant. Well, we're arguing that don't bother doing this in lower organisms because you can do the experiment in human cells. So we're going to do it in human cells. And I would say that the idea, again, for establishing these connections is not to be able to
be perfect.
I think people who think that you can create like a wiring diagram and reverse engineer a cell are out of their minds, you know, based on these data. It's just not feasible. So the question is, can you find, for example, enrichment in the same GSEA kind of thinking? Can you find enrichment of one signature in another, thereby establishing connectivity? In which case, you know, yes, you'll get some of it wrong because the context isn't right or the species mapping isn't right, but will you be able to see enough connection to establish connectivity? Yep.
Sure.
Yep, certainly some. We're finding, actually, I'll give you a couple examples, that while that is certain to be, that context dependence is certain to be the case.
There's lots that's shared.
And so, you know, when we first started talking about this project, there were a lot of objections to the idea, what if you don't choose the right cell line to do this in? You know, ideally you would do it in like 100 different cell types, but then it gets to be a serious experiment, you know, even in one cell line, it's a huge experiment.
Well, I think I told this in the group, but I've seen the same endocrinological relationships in many, many cell types that never people predicted would be there, and it's just there.
Yeah, exactly. So let me give a couple examples, and then we'll end. So, and it also comes back to this idea of enrichment looking for enrichment using a Kolmogorov-Smirnov enrichment test. So here is an experiment published not by us, but by a group at Abbott Laboratories, where they're interested in this class of drugs called histone deacetylase inhibitors. They took, what is it, five of these things, treated cells, took a common set of genes that were regulated, and defined a signature of 22 genes. It's a gene set. It's the HDAC inhibitor gene set. Okay. We took breast cancer cells, not the cell type they used, and treated them with a bunch of different drugs, including one, valproic acid, which is actually used to treat seizures, as it turns out. It was later discovered valproic acid actually has histone deacetylase inhibitory activity. It's kind of weak, but it's there. And we ask, can we see enrichment of this signature in any of those compounds? And the answer is yes. So tricostatin A was actually, where is it? Here's the top one. Was one of the drugs that they used to define the signature. So we recovered it, not surprisingly, but it's a little bit cheating because it wasn't a new example. But here you see sodium valproate, third and fourth ranked on the list, which was not used to define the signature, but simply based on the signature connectivity, had we not known it, we could have rediscovered that, we could have discovered that sodium valproate was an HDAC inhibitor because of this connectivity. You can also see here tricostatin A. So the signature is defined, I can't even remember, in one cell type, and we see it triggering the signature, the HDAC inhibitor signature, in breast cancer cells and in leukemia cells. So it's robust to context. Interestingly, we also ran our little connectivity, mini connectivity map across the oxidative phosphorylation signature we defined.
Does valproic acid cause hypoglycemia?
It does. We didn't know that. We thought we discovered something new.
Yeah,
but there's
the wrong specialty.
And the wrong specialty, yeah, it was reported about 20 years ago that valproate causes hypoglycemia and modulates oxidative phosphorylation. Separable activities, separable from the anti-seizure activity, separable from the HDAC inhibitor activity, and they trigger separate gene sets. So one last example. Signature defined of a drug called rapamycin, which sits in this pathway, simplified here, of PI3 kinase, AKT, and a protein called mTOR. And it turns out that if you define the signature of rapamycin treatment here, it's defined in T cells, published by David Sabatini, and apply that signature to our connectivity map matrix, you see that rapamycin itself is recovered in two different cell types, but also this thing LY294002, which didn't know what that was initially, but then you look it up, it's actually an inhibitor of PI3 kinase, which is upstream of mTOR. So it puts in the same pathway two drugs that act together and trigger the same signature. So again, I don't think it's going to be possible in the near term to actually reconstruct signal transduction pathways in their entirety, but to be able to put either genes or drugs together in a pathway not previously known to be in the same pathway, I think is going to be possible with this sort of approach. So we're committed to figuring out how to launch what would be a large-scale public domain connectivity map project where we would do these perturbations and put the data in the public domain so that people could use the data to find their own connections.
Yeah. What will be the major difference between this project and that?
I'm not sure I know what.
I think she's talking about the NCI-16 expression, right?
Yeah, their expression when conditioned on the molecule.
On response to the molecules.
Yeah.
This is actual response to the molecules. So that data set is the resting untreated
expression
of the cell lines, which you can then correlate with how they respond. this is the acute changes of response. Because the nice thing about that experiment is that you only have to measure each cell line once, and then you can correlate it with all those things. Here, you actually have to do a microarray for each different. Yep. Okay. So last slide. Whoops. Let's skip that. There's some future challenges. Just to remember that these prognostic signatures that everyone's developing are really a function of therapy. So they're only as they're likely only to be useful if you continue to use the same therapy. So like in this medulloblastoma example, we can predict things pretty well as long as we're trying to predict response to therapy that was given 10 years ago. But the therapy has evolved, and it's not certain that our classifier will still hold. This is going to be challenging because the clinical trials are generally small and underpowered to do this kind of thing. Still not clear how, once these signatures are actually vetted and validated, what form will they take when they actually go to the clinic? Will they be a microarray? Maybe. I've sort of given you some ideas about how one might do signature-based chemical discovery, but turning a chemical into a drug, you know, is a big deal and not easy. And so for that reason, pharmaceutical companies aren't dropping their current approach to drug discovery in favor of this. And in general, how to integrate this kind of signatures into the drug development process is still something to think about. But I still think this notion of using these tools, whatever personalized medicine means, but to gain more insight into the particulars of a given individual's disease to better match them with an existing or a new therapeutic is likely to be here to stay, even though there aren't a lot of examples of it happening yet. That's all I have.